Welcome to another edition of the All Souls Forum on KKFI. Tonight's program features Father Michael Gilgannon. He's been a Bolivian missionary since the 1970s. Has a wealth of information about what South America is transforming itself into, as well as some dish on the new pope. We're going to have our usual short introduction, and then we will begin our program. This program was recorded on October the 20th of 2013 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri. Let us have our introduction, and then we'll listen to Father Michael Gilgannon.
My name is Craig Volland. I'm a member of the Forum Committee. All right, this morning we're very privileged to have Father Michael Gilgannon. He is a Catholic priest from the Kansas City St. Joseph Diocese. He served 38 years as a missionary in Bolivia and co-founded the campus ministry program at the State University of La Paz in Bolivia. And I've already had a wonderful conversation with him about his deep experience and what he's going to talk about. So I'll let him take it from here.
Thank you, and we'll get into the conversation. Before I get into it, to some of the things I would like to share with you, you will see these kind of spaced around in the different chairs, different rows. These are just for your information, and because the annual November demonstration at Fort Benning, Georgia, will be bringing together a large number of different groups of people who have been going every year for years to Fort Benning, as well as talking to the United States Congress about the possibility of closing down this center of training for the military of Latin America by American military forces. The history of the center is not a happy one. Many of the military dictators in Latin America over the last 30 or 40 years had come out of that training in Fort Benning. And so a number of different people, particularly a former Marianol priest, Father Roy Bourgeois, and a number of other people, and a number of other different Christian groups, have developed a program over the years, and they invite students and different groups, institutions, religious groups, to come and demonstrate, and then to speak to their congresspeople later about whether or not we ought to continue this kind of training and formation of military and police leaders in Latin America. So that's just for your information, and you can read about it in the paper. And if you would want more, or your group might want to know more about that, it will be a gathering in later on in November, and it is an annual affair where people do cross the line and they do go into the fort. And then they go to jail for that because they are protesting something as a civil right in a democratic society with something that they deeply disagree with. So that's simply for your information. So I would like to speak to you more from my experience. I'm 38 years out of the mission that the Catholic Diocese of Kansas City, St. Joseph, had begun in the early 1960s with the sister Archdiocese of La Paz, Bolivia. The connections had been made by various of the church authorities, and the invitation was given to various groups, Catholic priests in the diocese, women religious communities in the area, like the Sisters of Charity of Leavenworth, and a number of lay mission volunteers who agreed to accept a 5-year program of service. So that program continued as it did from many Catholic church groups all over this country, all through the 60s, 70s, 80s, etc., down to the present time. It was a moment, especially from both the religious side, but also from the social side, of a great change, a great historical change that was taking place in Latin America. So I had been a campus ministry chaplain here at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, from 1965 to 1974, and I had begun to be quite interested in the problems that were beginning to happen with not only the Cold War, but with the outcome of the end of colonialism in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And so I had been working with people on some of those issues, not only here in Kansas City, but at the national level as well. So when the local bishop asked for anyone, any priest who might want to volunteer for the 5-year program, I said that I would be very interested in going. So I went in 1974 to La Paz, Bolivia, and so I'd like to kind of share that experience with you, so I don't forget it, as I often do when I get into the conversation with people. A couple of things that you might want to make reference to for yourselves to read later on. There's a couple of national institutions which have regular and very solid information about the problems of Latin America and the changing relationships of the United States, the government and its people, and the peoples of Latin America. One would be the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, and you can look these up simply in the internet for all sorts of information on different countries of Latin America that is quite solidly based, both political and social and economic. The Council on Hemispheric Affairs, usually you can just put COHA in Google, and COHA, and you will get the reference, which will give you all sorts of information on the various countries and the problems in relation to Latin America. And another one would be the Washington Office for Latin America, WOLA. They, too, particularly have put their emphasis, on the process of change, social and economic, in Latin America, with the drug problem in the United States, because, as you know, the highlands of Bolivia and Colombia and Peru supply the main base of cocaine for the world. So that the drug problem in the United States is intimately related with the economic growth and development and problems of some Latin American countries, and, of course, Mexico with marijuana and with heroin, as well as with synthetic drugs, all present problems. So you can get a lot of information from the Washington Office for Latin America. They have a number of books written about the continued economic use of coca in the Andes as the base for cocaine in the world. So that's those sources will fill in a lot of the things that I will be speaking to you about this morning. I went because of my growing interest in the 1960s and 70s of what we were seeing at the university level. As you know, the baby boomers were coming into the universities in great numbers. The churches and other groups were beginning to respond and to say maybe we need to accompany these young people. And, of course, it was a time of great social change in the United States with the civil rights movement and the gradually dawning realization that the colonial wars of the past were being replayed in the Cold War with something like the war in Vietnam. And as students and others began to protest that, more and more working in universities in the United States, it was necessary to begin to see the connections that were going to be developing as the world was going to historically begin to see the end of the kind of colonialism that had been driving factor of human development for a couple of centuries. Migration was always, of course, as we know, a part of human evolution from the very beginning. But in the colonial period, the nations of Europe, and then gradually the United States, began to discover their need for natural resources to continue in their technological and scientific development, and they began to extend their development into what we called underdeveloped countries or undeveloped countries in Latin America and Asia and Africa. And so those were the situations that we began to see when we went as missionaries and as Catholics, particularly thinking in terms of we would help out in Latin America because of the Catholic traditions, the Catholic culture. What we found, of course, was these changes were going far beyond anything that anybody could have prepared us for. You probably have heard of the difficulties in the past of something like the theology of liberation. Well, the theology of liberation, to know more of what it's where it was coming from and what it meant at the time in the 1960s and 70s, you'd have to know a little bit about the Cold War. You'd have to know something about Karl Marx. You'd have to know something about Karl Marx and the entire difficulties and discussions in German philosophy and theology of the 19th and 20th centuries. And you would also have to know of the extreme colonial control of all Latin American countries, first by Europe, particularly with Spain and Portugal, and then later by the United States. And so those kinds of historical forces began to come together in the Cold War, as also, we know from the civil rights movement here in the United States, the dawning realization that the democracies of the Enlightenment, like the United States, of the 17th, 18th, 19th century, were not always that enlightened. In fact, they were often racist and classist, and that philosophically justified by their understanding of their own worlds and their own religious backgrounds and their own culture. And then as that began to, that kind of background began to come into conflict with the cultural movements of change in these other countries and these other continents like Latin America and Asia and Africa, we began to see coming out of the European Cold War and the United States of Russia and the United States, more or less we are the powers that control the world. We have the most military might. We're fighting for supremacy. We have supposedly Marxism and capitalism and democracy as our ideological framework, and we are going to lead the world towards this great human future, one way or the other, from one side or the other. Well, that was what was playing out in Latin America when I got there in the 1970s. Bolivia was at that time, continues to be somewhat, one of the poorest countries in Latin America and at one time in the world. It had been landlocked. It had great natural resources. And if you would read some of your history, as I began to do, because I had never gotten some of that history in my studies in colleges here in the 1950s and 1960s, that For instance, the capital base of capitalism is actually what the Spanish took from Latin America, particularly Peru and Bolivia, in taking out the and Mexico the silver and of course the gold and any other materials they could find, because that money went to Spain, which then Spain was going to pay for all their wars until the Armada and a lot of other things were sunk as it didn't work out. But a lot of money from exploited people taken from Latin America went into Europe and became really the basic, the economic base of what we would later come to call capitalism. That is, the money came from slave labor, and the money came into Europe and came into the banks of Europe as Spain and Portugal were trying to continue their colonial control and finance, and their kings were financing their wars with the bankers of Europe, who then began to take the money, and of course Spain and Portugal eventually collapsed in bankruptcy, but the money was there, and it went all over, and it gradually became the basis for something like a book on the Wealth of Nations of Adam Smith, and the basis of what capitalism is supposedly all about. I'm sure Adam Smith and probably Karl Marx would both turn over in their graves if they were to come back today, either to universities or to the analysis given in both Europe and the United States of what we now mean as it has historically evolved from those arguments over capitalism and Marxism and socialism of the past. But when we got there in the 1960s and 70s, we got to Latin America with the hope, as I say, of religious people. We wanted to help people. We wanted to do good. And we found this terrible poverty, and we found that it was historically conditioned and accepted because there was an historic acceptance of the old European class and race structures, so that in 1825, when the Bolivar revolution was finally separating Latin America from Europe, the classes, the upper classes, usually the Spanish names, Spanish family names, or Portuguese family names, who had the control of the land and the agriculture, as well as the natural resources, really just continued European aristocracy and European control under the name of a new democratic republic. So Venezuela, Colombia, separate, if you've ever read some of the history of the life of Simón Bolívar, the sad and tragic history of his eventual death and the separation of Colombia and Venezuela, and the continuing problems of the republics of Latin America. Well, in Bolivia, that really continued until until this century, and in the other countries as well. A class and race distinction, which in a case like Bolivia and Peru and some of the other countries, some of the countries of Central America, meant that they were able to continue family control, generation after generation, ownership of lands, ownership of natural resources, on top of a slave society, so that they said, oh, we are free and independent because with Bolivar we have brought the great tradition, or rather the great questioning of Europe, to begin now the great traditions of ending the monarchy, the aristocracy, with republics and democratic societies. Well, that is still yet to come in Latin America. It is still trying hard to develop its own democratic and republic societies that are inclusive, but as Bolivia's experience particularly would show, that's just barely coming to fruition. The work that we found when we got there to Latin America, to Bolivia, was a society that was totally classist and racist. The majority of the people of the country were, in fact, natives. They were 60 or 70% of the country. Aymara, Quechua, Guarani, and the river tribes of the Amazon. The new constitution of Bolivia would say that there are 36 ethnic groups that are recognized by the new governmental constitution of Bolivia, with rights to be who they are and, in fact, to continue their customs in some of their own territories. That is totally new in Bolivia and really in Latin America. But that history was after the Bolivar Revolution that really only changed the status of the upper class so that they could control the country. The Latin American societies continued really very much as if they were simply a continuation of the aristocracies of class and race in Europe. So from 1825 on, they continued to argue among the families, certainly that was true in Bolivia, who was going to be the next president or who was going to control the Congress, who was going to control the mines, who was going to control the land, but there was no attention paid to the native peoples. So the United States, of course, came into that towards the end of the 19th century. We had our adventures in Mexico and, of course, in the Southwest, so that the interesting history of the annexation of much of Mexico and Spanish America by the United States is a very interesting part of American expansionism in the Southwest that continues to be a problem to this day, as we know from the tremendous arguments and difficulties of the border states about immigration. What are we going to do? And many of course, the Mexican people, some of whom I continue to work with here with Spanish groups in the city with masses and talks, would say, we were always here. We're as much Mexican or as much American. We go back and forth. We did go back and forth all the time before we put in the wall that now separates us from Mexico because of our inability to arrive at some sort of a consensus about a new immigration law that would include people who are already here in the United States. So one of the things that I wanted to call your attention to today is that these difficulties of the past and the colonial controls of the past, while their names have changed, we are finding they are still a real struggle for Latin America. And one of the indications that I mentioned in the title for this, that America's back porch is no longer in America's back pocket, is simply a play on the words that John Kerry recently used a couple of months ago in speaking to the Congress about his new responsibilities in the State Department. And he used the phrase that we want to continue our friendships with our Latin American neighbors. They are, after all, America's back porch or America's patio. Well, in Spanish, that has always been treated as patio trasero, or back porch, or America's patio. To speak of the countries of Latin America are now more and more and more taken as a direct insult to the sovereignty of each country of Latin America. We are not the back porch of the United States. We are sovereign nation states. We are looking to have more and more internal control of our own resources so that we can develop our own peoples in our own way according to our cultures and our ways. So the back porch has begun to say, we don't want to be America's back porch in America's back pocket. We don't any longer want to be considered as a natural resource storage for American use when American businesses and finance and governments decide that they want to take control of one part or another of our countries, as they have historically done. So that's what we as missionaries began to learn when we got to Latin America in the 70s. What is the Cold War really about in countries like Latin America? Where did the Marxists come from, for instance? Well, of course, most of them really came into the universities of Latin America from the universities of Europe. And they began to try to simply say, we really have never functioned as independent nation-state republics in the countries of Latin America. We have always accepted dependency because our leadership, our class and race leadership, had long since decided it was better to go along with the decisions of European developers and owners, and then later of the United States owners and developments of almost any resource that Latin American countries had. So we know of the Spanish-American War. We know of the banana republics of Central America. We know of people like Che Guevara and the Cuban Revolution, mostly misunderstood here in the United States, because they weren't understood as anything other than a kind of an extension of the Cold War, when in fact they were the development similar to what had happened in the United States a century or two before, which is to say, we want to be separated from the European control of our lives and our governments and our resources so that we can begin to be whoever we are or whoever we might want to become, because we don't any longer want to see ourselves, nor do we want others to see us, as simply an extension of Europe or the United States, and particularly, of course, as that referred to natural resources. So the development that we thought we were going to help out the Catholic Church in Latin America, some would say that some of those calls to service were maybe also supported by Rome and by the popes, because of the communist threat, and the communist threat as understood in Europe, particularly Eastern Europe, and certainly in places like Germany and Poland, who then supplied the Catholic Church with two of the last popes. From that kind of an experience of Europe that was seen as being translated into revolution in Latin American countries. So what we found when we arrived were a very excluded people who had been literally slaves of the owners, as I say, mostly with the aristocratic names of Spain and Portugal, for about five centuries. The titles of the change control may have changed, but the control was still there. And so the Marxists were able to use that, and we got to know a lot of those Marxists because we began to find that, as in Europe with the fascists, when you begin to question the status quo, you probably will end up in the same prisons. So the Jewish people and the Catholics who opposed fascism in Germany and in Italy, and there are a number of stories about those people, some of whom have ended up as saints in the Catholic Church, went to the same prisons, and they begin to talk about what is really happening to us, to our society. What is National Socialism? What is fascism? What is Marxism and communism? What is and what would be a true democracy of inclusion of all our people and a real equality among our people, but also a real equality under the of the people of all nations. What would that now mean? Well, in Latin America, in the last 50 years, we have seen that that kind of globalization of the historical processes of the past, whether we're talking about the Enlightenment or the Scientific Revolution or technology, are coming to bear on the development of countries that were previously owned and operated, in the case of Latin America, as America's back porch. We own you, and we tell you what to do, and we don't do it as an aristocracy, nor are we an imperial empire. We do it because we want to help you. And so we will bring you technical people, skilled people, financial people, political people, and they will help you to develop. But basically and underneath it all, you will develop in the ways that we want for our resources, and we're really not going to ask you about it. We are going to do it. And we will find the ways to get the right people elected, and they will have Spanish names, they won't have Indian names, and they won't look like Indians, because we know that those people are incapable of governing themselves. So that is the kind of history we actually lived with in Bolivia. Certainly I know from personal experience from 1974 on. It had been going on a long time before I got there. But it was these historical forces that were beginning to question that kind of relationship and control, particularly with Europe and the United States on resource control, as the globalization process continued. And so that began, as I say then, to also highlight, well, what's at stake in the Cold War? What kind of capitalism and ownership are we really talking about? Who owns, as the Bolivians said in 2000, the year 2000 in Cochabamba? You might look up a movie called También la lluvia, which is and also the rain, and the title of the movie, which won various international awards, is what is called the Water Wars in Cochabamba. They Bolivia began a series of economic changes to sell off everything that they had after they had very difficult economic times in the 1980s and 1990s. They were deeply in debt to the IMF, the World Bank, but particularly to national banks in the United States, who in the 1970s and 80s were trying to get out working all the dollars that they had from the bonanzas of oil in the beginning of OPEC and the beginning of countries who did try and take control of their own oil. But what were they going to do with the money they got out of it? Well, they put it in U.S. and European banks, and then the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund lent it out. But who did they begin to lend it out to in the 1960s and 70s but the military dictators who had taken over in the name of the Cold War? We are going to defeat the Marxists and the communists and the atheists who are out there. And we are going to make them all democratic participation in development, the economic development that we want. You might read Jeffrey Sachs, the noted economist, who switched from Harvard to Columbia, in his book On the End of Poverty, where he gives a chapter to what happened when he, as a young Harvard economist, was asked to give a plan to Bolivia in the 1980s and 1990s. Sell everything you have, all the natural resources. Let the people who know what they're doing with technology come in and really develop it, because we know that you people just aren't capable of developing it yourselves. And, of course, we've never educated you. That was another thing we found as missionaries. The Aymara people, the Quechua people, the Guarani people in Bolivia, and that's true all over Latin America and Mexico as well, were never educated. They were kept in their small villages. They were allowed. They weren't slaves legally, always. Some were, but mostly weren't. You can be who you want to be, but you'll do what we tell you. And no, you don't have to go to school. Just keep speaking Aymara or Quechua. No, the wives and mothers don't have to learn how to read or write. I mean, why would they? They aren't going to be doing anything other than raising children if they can get maybe seven out of ten children to live. They will have probably three of them out of every ten die. Yeah. So we began to see that the problems of selling off everything you have begins to say you really end up without any control over your own natural resources. So the movie I mentioned was a chronicle made by Spanish and Bolivians about the water wars with the Bechtel Corporation in the year 2000 in Cochabamba, which was a part of the changes that are bringing about the great changes in Bolivia. The head of the coca grower union was Evo Morales. He had begun to organize people for some time around the right to grow coca. The drug control people of the United States were beginning to use military control and killing Native peoples who were beginning to grow coca in areas that were supposed to be off limits. And Cochabamba was nearby, one of those areas. And so the Cochabamba water wars was just another step. We want to own our own water, so we're going to throw Bechtel out. And when we began to think about our Bolivians began to think about that, they said, not only Bechtel, but the international corporations that have owned us. And we are going to begin to really try and run our own country. Well, with the drug wars, the water wars, the various kinds of social conflicts, that's what has brought Evo Morales and the Indian peoples to the presidency and Congress of Bolivia. And that's happening all over Latin America in different ways. It isn't well reported up here. It is not well understood. It does take a lot of historical reflection. But it is about the new world, and it's about the questions, even with something like this that I say as I pass out to you. Something like the protests at Fort Benning are not anti-government or anti-military, but they are saying that the time of military control and training of people in other countries to maintain the status quo of social injustice between nations in the historic globalization process that's going on, we can't continue that. We, the United States, the people, we can't continue that. Partly because if we try, we are going to bankrupt this country. We are not going to be able to continue the kinds of control. We've got to work out some new relationships of recognition and of tolerance and also of respect for other countries and their governments and their ways, as we're seeing in something like the Middle East. Is it the struggle with the dictators like 50 years ago or 60 years ago in Europe? There are many questions about that. Are we talking about the struggles for world resources and who's going to own them and who's going to direct them towards the future? And is that the globalization struggle of the future? Not for the United States or Europe, for the world, for the entire human family. And that is what is not reported, commented, analyzed up here in the United States or in Europe. I would recommend that you read a terrible condemnation of Hugo Chavez on the occasion of Chavez's death by The Economist. They may or may not agree with Hugo Chavez. He was, after all, elected four times by his people in the closest thing to a democratic election that they could have. International observers, it ends up that The Economist's commentary on the death of well, you know, he was a radical, he was a demagogue, he was taking over people's private enterprise, et cetera, et cetera. Very distorted reporting. It shows that the people who wrote it are writing ideologically. They're not writing about a real, live human being. They are presenting a point of view that you may or may not agree with, but you would think that so many other people know another side of the story you're telling that you'd at least give some respect to the other side of the story. Because if you don't, people will begin to think professionally you don't know what you're doing. And you say, that's The Economist? That was and is magazines and media in the United States and Europe still acting as if we can think of Latin America as our patio trasero. It's our backyard. And the people of Latin America are simply saying, we are no longer in your back pocket. Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question about your life experience as a missionary, and sort of in relation to the significance of now having a pope from the Southern Hemisphere. Would it be possible to imagine yourself at the frame of mind and place you were in 1974 or advising a young man who was perhaps considering following your path in 2014? What's different? What comes to mind?
Well, I think, and there are a number of books written by missionaries and others about, the mentality of help that we all had. You know, I think there was great sincerity. I would argue also that the books had not yet been written about the kinds of influence that the developing, I can speak for the Catholic Church, the developing conscience of the end of colonial Catholicism and cultural Catholicism in Latin America, and the debates and difficulties that were part of the Cold War over the national and international ideologies of Marxism and capitalism and socialism by people who were trying to figure out, we don't want to continue the colonialism of the past. Where do we want to go, and how are we going to get there? And so church people, to mention again what I had mentioned, when you find yourselves under the same gun and you're in the same prison or you're in exile because you have these desires for social change, whether you're Marxist or Catholic or whatever, wherever you're coming from, you begin to talk with each other as they did in the German prison camps and as we did in Bolivia when we had terrible dictatorship. It was a terrible time in the 1970s and in 1980, 81, and 82 in Bolivia and in other parts of Latin America. And the Pope, of course, knows that terrible experience of Argentina, this very Catholic country, like Germany and like Italy, that had no problem killing people over their ideological positions and putting them in exile, not bothering with trials or evidence, just on the suspicion that they were of another ideological point of view. So that, the great change, I am personally very optimistic. I lived through the dictatorships. I know what it was like. We suffered with it and we lived with the people. We hid people just as the Pope did. There's a couple of new articles with some friends have sent me from Italian sources. They're in Italian and Spanish. I haven't seen an English translation of a more complete report, for instance, on the Pope and the fact that he, like so many others, was helping a lot of people to get out from under the military dictatorship and get out of the country, as we did in Bolivia. And everybody did. I visited Santiago, Chile with Pinochet. I saw the missionary's house was shot up because they thought that there were some subversives there in the house. And they were at times keeping people, as we did in our parishes. for protecting them, because there was no judicial process. It was strictly a military dictatorship on ideological grounds. So my optimism is that that forced all sorts of people to come together, Marxists and people of great Catholic faith, as well as forcing a lot of people to say, is there such a thing as Catholic culture? Well, we're all Catholic in this country because historically we always have been. There's a lot of questioning. Religion is supposed to be part of conscience. It's supposed to be free choice. It's supposed to know what you think and why you think it, so that then you act out the values that you have. And those are free values. And if you don't want to do it, don't do it. And if you do want to do it, well, then do it. Like, it makes a difference. It means something. I am very hopeful that the changes in Latin America are really going to bring about some great changes in Latin America, and necessarily in this relationship that I mentioned before with the United States. We can't keep treating the countries of Latin America as we are.
My question goes back to the 50s and 60s, when some of these countries were doing import substitution industrialization. And I believe the CIA, you know, when people in the CIA took out Allende and also in Argentina and Uruguay and some of these other countries and wiped out that model so that they could continue the dependency of the people there, so that rather than produce their own industrial products, that they'd keep doing that. So my concern is that the CIA has a lot of drones, and sometimes it's been reported they get their money off illicit drugs like heroin or coca. And so I'm not sure what the true dynamic is of what's going on in the world. But my question, if the School of Americas was shut down, wouldn't the CIA and the people that control the way they operate, wouldn't they find a way to just use drones to continue their dominance?
Well, I'm sure they would. Yeah, that's a whole other time. We have a couple of other forums sometime on the fact that the United States is losing its sense of proportion about freedom and human and civil rights. We could easily slip into fascist control system. We are operating on fear. And this year, being back here in the United States after 38 years, I would come back maybe every year or two, maybe for a month or so. But actually being here, living here, we are really beset by fear in this country, and fear is devastating, as I saw in Latin America. If you're afraid of your own principles and what might happen to you and you get with other people, then you want to repress anybody who might threaten that. You're afraid of life. We are becoming a country that's afraid of life. We therefore have to put all of our money in defense spending. We aren't the free and open nation that we once were, and the drones and the others, I think, are just an indication of that. Again, I don't think it's anti-American to say that. I think it's a call to reflection in this country. Germany and Italy were not, fascist countries from the beginning. They slipped into it because of historical circumstances, and people let it go, and then something like the recent movie Hannah Arendt, the banality of evil, it probably wasn't, and that's true in Latin America. That was true of some of the people I knew. It's not like they're evil, terrible, calculating people. They're just doing their job, and their job is being told to them by people who have made the analysis that says, we have to do this for the protection and security of our people. We need a national debate. I wouldn't say that Mr. Snowden or the others, took the best avenue to do that. I don't think we have to approve of that exactly. But on the other hand, this country needs a national debate on the very same issues. We cannot allow ourselves to have intercepted phone calls. I had that. I lived with that. phone taps, people following you. I had a very good friend, Jesuit friend, who was murdered, assassinated, because he was publishing comments on the military and the injustices. You live it, and you know it, and you know where it comes from, and you say, you don't want to live with that kind of fear in a free nation. You want to debate, and you want to say, this is a better way than that. Let's argue about it. But you you don't want drones and wiretaps and email interceptions by your own government. And if we reach that point, forget democracy and forget equality, and you can expect repression, military repression without trial. That's the end of it. That's where it goes. Unless people get in on the debate and say, well, I can't watch the Chiefs this week. I have to go to a meeting that's going to talk about the freedom to say what we think in public. Yeah.
Question about contemporary Bolivia. I've read in recent years about the huge natural resource, I think it's in the Altiplano of Peru and Bolivia, the lithium, which is a key component in batteries with huge implications for the automobile industry and other industries. And they have this tremendous resource now. And Morales has said that he wants to develop this on his own rather than let foreign capital in. Could you give us an update on that?
Yeah, that's a continuing story, and it will continue to need updates. Yeah, they're working on it. They continue to work on it. China wants in. Iran wants in. France wants in. Korea wants in. A number of countries who have the technical know-how and scientific ability to do it want in on it. It is one of the largest lithium deposits in the Western Hemisphere. And it's underneath a salt desert-like lake in the southwest of Bolivia. The arguments of the government at the moment are you can't take it out. We want you to help take it out. So they've got the technical people and scientific people are starting to do that. But if you do that, and if we give you the right to do that for export, you have to also build on site a lithium battery factory for Bolivia so that it won't be like the gas and oil, which at the moment is just being pumped out of Bolivia. But one last word in relation to that. What this government has done with its problems and certainly with corruption and other things as they learn democracy is the redistribution of the gas and oil benefits have really changed Bolivia. You read some of the new articles on Bolivia from Better Resources than the Economist in the New York Times, and you would see that it's becoming what maybe will become sort of a middle-class country. Well, when I went there in 1974, I couldn't believe the poverty. It was incredible. The Indian poverty, the people in the villages, it was just destitution. Well, that's what this Indian government has begun to redistribute. So they are building schools and hospitals and all over the country. The Cubans came in, of course, the Cuban doctors, the Cuban educators for literacy. So all of that is changing a country like Bolivia almost overnight. And it is changing it for the better. In the middle of it, I sometimes used to think, and we could maybe close with that, because I'm from an Irish Catholic family of Kansas City of a couple of generations, so we all knew, how much cement it takes to build the Brush Creek, and we know that that puts Catholic and others to work. And we know that that's the way you get democracy functioning and redistributing. You get some corruption in the middle of it. You also get people learning how to govern and govern themselves. So you begin to understand that the urban machine of a Pendergast people in their time with the Irish firemen and maybe the Irish policemen we're all steps along the way. We will bring our people in because we've all banded together. We won the election because we went to the precincts. That's what Evo Morales has done in Bolivia. And they win the election. Every commentator you will read, Evo Morales will be reelected next year. There's no group out there that could possibly beat him. And they will charge, graft, and everything. It's all there. But it steps along the way because, in fact, also, as the urban machines in New York and Boston and Chicago and here, in their day, did redistribute. They brought the people who were excluded into the process. They did get corrupt, and they did get set in their ways and think that they could keep running it indefinitely. But in the meantime, those are steps along the way. I think in any democratic process, African nations will have to learn the same thing. But we'll see where it goes.
You've been listening to Father Michael Gilgannon, who's been a missionary in Bolivia since the 1970s. He's got a lot of experience with our South American neighbors, and I think it shows in what he told us tonight. This program was recorded on October the 20th of 2013 at the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City. This program is produced and edited for broadcast each week by Barry Lee. Thank you to Rita Norton and the staff at All Souls for their help each week in producing these programs for you. Tune in again next week for another All Souls Forum. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.